John Hockenberry here. Thank you for downloading this podcast from WNYC and Public Radio International. You're a very discriminating person, I can tell that. Remember, we're as keen to hear from you as we are from John in Dallas or Joan in Eugene. You can follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway and find out more at thetakeaway.org. Here then, for your listening pleasure, is The Takeaway Podcast. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And, you know, we might actually be rating you as a listener and scoring the data on our website. And if you score low, well, think about it. Maybe in time for the next pledge drive, right? Actually, rating customers is the new rage for online websites. And we will explore the perils of businesses sorting out which customers are permitted to be always right with New Tech City's Manoush Zomorodi later this hour. And a mom explains the rapidly expanding universe theory for Earth's biggest cosmic celebrity. Think about it. I'm not going to give it away now. That puzzle will be solved a little later in the show. Plus, we will continue our provocative conversations about the kidnapping situation in Nigeria and what it means to the world with social activist and feminist author Bell Hooks. But first, veterans are not giving a good rating to the head of the Department of Veterans Affairs, General Eric Shinseki. Yesterday, he responded.
I offer my condolences to these families for anyone who's lost a veteran, any unexpected death in one of our facilities. What I want veterans to know, all the rest who are watching what's going on, I want them to know that this is a good quality healthcare system. Not perfect, and when we stumble across our imperfections, we're going to do something about it. We get to the bottom of it, and to the best of our abilities, assure it never happens again.
Secretary Shinseki is responding to charges first reported by CNN and now under investigation by Congress that VA facilities have unacceptable wait times for treatment, that veterans have died while waiting for treatment, that facilities have concealed those long wait times to make their facilities look as though they're being more responsive to patients than is actually the case, and that some facilities had a secret waiting list that favoritism could get you treatment faster than if you just waited in line. Shinseki has ordered what he is calling a face-to-face audit at all VA clinics.
My responsibility is to ensure that review is done quickly and thoroughly, and then something is done about it.
Not quickly enough for the American Legion, though. The veterans organization that for many years has been fiercely loyal to the VA is calling for Mr. Shinseki and two other senior department officials to step down. Joining me now is Verna Jones, Director for Veterans Affairs and Rehabilitation at the VA Rehabilitation Commission at the American Legion National Headquarters. Verna, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
How unprecedented a step is this for the Legion?
The Legion hasn't done anything like this for 30 years, so it takes a lot for us to get to the point where we're going to call for a top VA official to step down. Very unprecedented.
Let me take the VA's theoretical position. I don't know what their position is. We reached out to them. They didn't respond to us. We will try to get them to respond to your remarks today. We'll see what happens. But they might make the argument that two wars, an explosion of VA issues of all kinds, and we're just trying to sort this out, and we need continuous leadership to make that happen here. What would you say to that?
You know, I agree. We understand that we're coming out of the wars, and more veterans are going to the VA healthcare system. That's a good thing, and we're not complaining about that. If it takes a little bit longer, it takes a little bit longer, but be upfront about it. Our issue is that there's a secret waiting list and that veterans are dying because of this, and allegedly 40 veterans in Phoenix. That's unacceptable. If it takes a little bit longer, then find a process that's going to take care of the veteran to make sure that they get in and get the care that they need and be upfront about it.
Specifically, Verna Jones, do you believe that veterans died at the facility in Phoenix because somebody was bumped up the secret list?
You know, I don't know. That's an ongoing investigation. We're going to wait and see, and we certainly hope not. We know that 40 deaths have been allegedly linked to that Phoenix secret waiting list, and we're awaiting the results of the investigation.
Is there a general sense among veterans that you can make a call to somebody at a VA facility and get some kind of treatment, that it's about working the system, not waiting in line?
You know, the general sense among veterans is that they've served the country and they deserve the health care system that's created for them, and they deserve a timely approach to their health care. Veterans just want to be seen at the VA and they want to be taken care of. They want service just like they serve the country, and they deserve that.
What has been your experience at the American Legion reaching out to Eric Shinseki and trying to get him to be responsive to your concerns prior to taking this step calling for his resignation?
Right. So we work with the Undersecretary of Health and the Undersecretary of Benefits and many people who work at the VA. And I'll tell you that most of the people who work at the VA want to go to work and do a good job. And we have a great working relationship with people who work at the VA. It's just when things like this happen, we need timely responsiveness. We needed to hear Secretary Shinseki come out before anyone else and say, you know, we have a problem, we're looking into it, and we're going to figure out what's going on and fix it. And we didn't hear that. So that's disappointing to us.
When General Shinseki was appointed by the Obama administration, it was really a reversal of how he was forced into retirement by the Bush administration for calling for more troops, for supporting the troops in Iraq, and really being ignored. And his appointment was seen as a really emotional endorsement of the soldier perspective and the veteran's perspective here. Has he lost all of that sort of good feeling going in here with this scandal?
You know, Secretary Shinseki served his country, and he served this country honorably, and we'll never forget that. We're very proud of the service that Secretary Shinseki has given to this country, and you can't discount that. What we're concerned about is the fact that veterans are not getting the treatment that they deserve in these VA healthcare facilities, and we want that to happen. And that's why the American Legion called for Secretary Shinseki's resignation, because we believe that veterans deserve to go into that facility and have full confidence that they're going to receive timely treatment and that they're going to be better because they have a healthcare system built for them.
He's been called to testify next week, where he'll be in the hot seat. Is there anything from your perspective at the American Legion that the secretary can do at this point to vindicate, redeem himself?
Transparent. That's what we're looking for. Some transparency. Tell us what you know. See how we can fix it. And the American Legion stands ready to assist in any way that we can.
Verna Jones is director of the Veterans Affairs and Rehabilitation Commission at the American Legion National Headquarters. Verna Jones, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We seek to get a response from the VA to Verna Jones' remarks and the position of the American Legion. So far, we haven't heard from them, but we will deliver that message to you if and when we get it. So you may forget your keys, your wallet, or leave the house with unmatched socks, but no one forgets what their mom told them, right? Advice etched on the brains, hearts, and souls of all of us.
This is Susan from St. Paul, Minnesota. My best advice is if you run out in the road, you'll get run over flat like a pancake. That's my best advice because it's my only advice that my 3-year-old son actually abides by and repeats.
I told my kids to live their dreams, travel, explore, do everything you want to do before you have children, because once you have children, the world's no longer about you. It's about them. And so far, I am not a grandma, and I'm quite happy about that.
We try to instill in them a sense of self-worth, of self-responsibility, respect for others, and love of mankind.
That last voice, Sanchita Tony Tyson, mother of someone I'm sure you know. And while you're puzzling that, I'll tell you that Toni Tyson and her husband realized early on that they had their work cut out for them with 3 talented children growing up in the Bronx. Their oldest son was an artist. Their youngest had a talent for business and psychology. She would become a finance wizard in the energy industry. Their middle son was interested in the universe. All of it. Got it now? He would become the science celebrity force of nature, astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson. Neil's mom, Toni Tyson, will take us right into the weekend with a lovely conversation later this hour. But just to give you a little preview, she told us one of her main challenges as a mom raising 3 black children in the Bronx in the 1960s was keeping them focused and moving forward without getting distracted by obstacles related to race. She wanted her kids tough but not angry over things like the time young Neil brought a telescope into a public park one night and the police stopped him, thinking it was a weapon. Discouragement and anger, says Toni Tyson, were not options.
It was not easy. It was a full-time, 24-hour-a-day job. All 3 of my children are brown, and they stay brown all year round, and they can even get darker in the summertime. And we had to make it very, very clear to them at a very early age that people, some people are not going to be very nice to them, but it was not their problem. It was the person's problem. And as a result, when things did occur, we would get onto it immediately. For instance, there was a situation when Neil was in junior high school, and I read about a scholarship that was available by the Department of Education, federal. And I got the application, and Neil filled it out, and he did the essay, and he had to get three references. And there was one teacher that he listed. I said, I don't think that's a good idea. Don't use him. He says, oh, why, Mom? He's great. He's a wonderful teacher. I said, that has nothing to do with it. I don't think you should use him. To make a long story short, he did. And you know what he was told when he presented it to the teacher? He said, what makes you think you can get this scholarship? Because he came home devastated, and as a result, he used another teacher. I got vibes from this individual that I did not like during one of the Parent Teachers Association.
And the what makes you think question was because he was black.
Of course. Of course. Either that or he didn't think he could do it intellectually or scholastically. That was one incident. And then there's several others. This whole business with the telescope going into Van Cortlandt Park. I often wondered whether if they had been white, whether the police would have stopped them. Just small incidences like that. So it was a constant vigilance. During the when he was applying for colleges, I indicated to him that we were, for all three of our children, that we were going to be their counselors, that we were going to review their college applications, and we will discuss their colleges with them, and then take it to the guidance counselor at the schools, because I was afraid they were going to be deterred in some of their quests. And in Neil's case, he applied to various schools, and people wanted to know what his safety school was. Safety school was one of the Ivies, and they laughed at that. I said, don't pay any attention. Just send out the applications, okay? And then what happened was that many of his schoolmates wanted to continually ask him, what were your SAT scores? What were your SAT scores? This was the time of affirmative action, and I think that people were afraid that Neil was going to get preferential treatment at the time. Everything worked out well, but these are little things, little nitty-gritty things that we constantly had to be on the alert about.
But they can stick with you.
Of course they can.
And his success is so overwhelming. Went to Harvard, Columbia PhD. Now is, you know, runs the Hayden Planetarium that he used to go to as a boy.
Right.
But there's not any sense in that success that it's a there I showed you.
No, no.
Why?
Oh, no,
why?
No.
You gave that to him.
No. We told it very, listen, we have to be grateful for what we have. This could have turned out anyway. It could have gone in any direction, okay? And we tried to instill in them a sense of self-worth, of self-responsibility, respect for others, and love of mankind. I mean, we're all here. This is a journey we're all taking together, so we just be nice to each other and love and be kind to people. And it's just carried through, and all three of my kids have it.
More from Toni Tyson, mother of Neil deGrasse Tyson, later this hour. And for all our moms out there, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE and tell us the best gift you've given your children that's helped to shape who they are today. Again, that's 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TiVo. Recording up to 6 shows at once and 3,000 hours, plus Netflix, Hulu Plus, and YouTube. All on the TiVo Romeo DVR. TiVo.com.
Here's a what if that may be a snapshot of where the world is headed right now. I'm rushing to catch a flight, and I'll use the automatic check-in machine here.
Hello. How may I help you?
Okay, there's my flight.
How many bags do you have?
Just one. Okay.
Thank you. Press 1 if correct.
Frequent flyer number. Okay, key that in. Now seat selection, window, and let's get on the upgrade list, okay?
You are not eligible for an upgrade.
That's ridiculous. It's not even close to full.
You are not eligible for an upgrade.
That's nuts.
Your customer rating is insufficient for a window seat.
Customer rating? What is that?
It is a very low number. Mr. Hockenberry, would you like to see it?
No, forget it. Customer rating? Are you rating me right now?
Subtracting customer rating. Subtracting customer rating. Subtracting customer rating. Subtracting customer rating.
Subtracting customer rating.
Subtracting customer rating.
So, of course, we had to put this to Manoush Zomorodi, host of New Tech City.
Oh,
is
God.
This customer rating world where we are headed on planet Earth right now?
The answer is absolutely
Yes, and I want to tell you a story, okay? So a couple months back, I was thinking about customer ratings because of what happened to me when I took an Uber ride. Uber is this app-based
taxi service.
It's a service that matches you with available drivers who are licensed in your area.
And the drivers get to rate you as a passenger.
I didn't know that until the guy said to me, you know what? I almost didn't pick you up because your rating is so low. And I was like, what? Wait, first of all, I have a rating. Second of all, it's low. What the heck? And what was weird, John, is that was my first day using the app. So I could pinpoint I had taken 3 rides that day. So it had to be one of the 2 earlier rides that somebody just didn't like me, basically. You know, the first one, I told the guy I wanted to go to Clinton Avenue, not Clinton Street, as he kept insisting. And then the second one, when I didn't want to talk, I was like, oh, I'm going to wear my headphones. He was like, well, don't give me a bad rating just because you don't feel like talking. I did decide to take another ride and grill another driver as to what these ratings actually mean. So my driver this time was Ganir Salami.
Let's say you get inside my car. You late already. You know you're supposed to be at your job at 10 o'clock.
Uh-huh.
And you get inside my car 5 minutes to 10. And you know it's not possible to get there in 5 minutes. You get inside a car and you have a attitude like, oh, it's too much traffic. Oh, you're supposed to go this way. You're supposed to go this way. Definitely have to give you bad star.
Bad star.
Bad star or no star.
That's scary.
So it's this interesting new relationship between consumers and businesses. It's, you know, we're calling it the reputation economy, and the street goes both ways.
Why would businesses want to do this? I can see why limo drivers might want to do this, but why do businesses want to do this?
Well, you know, in the reputation economy, we're talking about sharing, right? So Uber, who declined an interview, but they did point us to a recent blog post that they happened to put up just after we told them we were doing this story, which basically said, in this new world, our drivers deserve not to have aggressive, violent, or another word that they used to
describe.
People
like you, basically.
I guess so. But, you know, I didn't use physical force and I certainly didn't vomit in the back seat. Maybe I didn't feel like chatting. But what worries me is that there's this new world where you – are you chipper? Are you happy? Are you so, so, so polite? Great. Then you get 5 stars. Oh, wait. You're having a bad day or you're a little bit grouchy or you don't feel like talking? Okay, 1 star. But having said that, I spoke to a University of Denver law professor, Nancy Leong, who says – It could even get more sinister than that.
All of these rating systems, while they certainly do have advantages, they also have ways in which people can manifest prejudices against various groups, whether they're doing so on purpose or without knowing it.
So this reputation economy becomes a kind of prejudice database.
Potentially. But how do you know if you don't get to see the data? Because nobody, you know, that lovely woman, the robot who you spoke to, offered to show you your rating, right? But that's not what's happening here. Mm. We don't know what those ratings are. The only rating that we really do know about is our credit score, right? We've been able to know about that since about 1970 because of the Fair Credit Reporting Act. But now there are some people who are saying, there's all kinds of consumer ratings that are being compiled by all of the information that we're pumping out from our phones, from our computers, soon from our homes, and we don't even know what they are. I spoke to a data privacy consultant. His name is Bob Gelman, and he sort of explained what could be scary about that.
I think that everybody's scoring everybody all the time on all kinds of characteristics. Do we all have to live according to a certain model in order to be treated properly in this economy? Is that the future that we face?
To say nothing of the fact that, you know, one really bad rating can have a huge impact. And that's what businesses report about their ratings.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And the White House is finally sort of waking up to this potential future. It had a big data report that was out last week that specifically calls for new privacy laws to combat potentially discrimination by data. And there's a new term that's coming out for this, which is digital redlining. Redlining, which is that term from the 60s.
Exactly. From real estate,
And banks, where they would literally write red lines around neighborhoods, usually with black and poor people living in them, to say, stay away from these people.
No mortgages there. No,
exactly.
No references and referrals there.
Exactly.
That's what redlining is all about. I guess this is unavoidable. There's nothing short of legislation that you can do other than just be polite.
which annoys me. So that's why I do think for, you know, I'm not usually for tons of legislation, but I have to say this is something that it needs to be transparent. It's extremely important that it's transparent.
Now, what if your story was you got a great rating on Uber and they sent a Cadillac to pick you up? Would you be doing the same story here on The Takeaway?
I don't think that I should be rated for my mood. I wanted to get from point A to point B, and I was paying for that. End of story.
We got to give Minutia a star for this segment to bump up her rating, maybe?
Come on, 5 stars. Give it to me, John.
How many stars does she have? Oh, that's a secret. Sorry. No. Manu Zamarodi, host of New Tech City.
Thanks, John.
Mama said she loves me, said she cares. Said if I need, she'll always be there. Mama, I'm coming home. Mother.
Mama said there'll be days like this. There'll be days like this, Mama said.
Mama what Mama said. That's right.
The best advice that I've given and continue to remind my son is to be able to be honest, both with himself and with others, while treating people the way he would like to be treated, always.
This is Amy in Arlington, Texas. I've always told my kids that if you work hard and keep focused, you can achieve anything.
Thanks to all you moms out there for Mother's Day. Why don't you just call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE and you tell us the best gifts you gave your kids. Maybe they'll write a song for you. Could happen.
But all that I can see is the temple bells are tolling for everyone about me. But I don't worry, cause Mama said there'll be days like this. There'll be days like this. My mama said.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
The month of May may be proving to be the cruelest month for the people of Ukraine, but it's been a party in Moscow lately. May Day's parade looked like something Joe Stalin would have enjoyed a little over a week ago. Today, it's Victory Day in Moscow. The sound of Victory Day celebrated all over Russia, actually. It marks 69 years since the Soviets defeated the Nazis. The nationalist fervor is infectious in this region. Pro-Russian groups in eastern Ukraine have decided to go ahead with an independence referendum on Sunday, despite calls from Vladimir Putin to delay it. And Putin himself found time to visit newly annexed Crimea on this Victory Day. Joining us now, Fred Weir, Moscow correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Fred, welcome.
Good day.
What's this sense of nationalism on this Victory Day, again, as visible a nationalist event as we've seen since Soviet times in Russia?
Well, this is an annual affair in Russia. The new element here is that Russia is on the march a little bit. It has annexed Crimea, and there is a more forward-leaning usages of that victory now in terms of confronting challenges from the West, challenges from Ukraine. A lot of Russian commentators, not Vladimir Putin, but a lot of people in the media sort of compare the challenge from Kiev with the fascist challenge of World War II. So there is quite a new mood.
Tell me about this visit to Crimea. Is this something he has to do, kind of an obligation to the people of Crimea who really wonder what this annexation is going to mean? Or is it something he's doing for his domestic audience, just showcasing this new territory?
Well, that and for the Western audience as well, because he's been roundly criticized for annexing Crimea, for breaking international law and throwing the world kind of back to a 1930s situation by doing that. And it is Vladimir Putin's style to push back and be defiant. And by going there and participating in a huge parade of naval and aviation hardware, he is sending the message that the annexation of Crimea is done and down. It will not be reversed.
Are there any voices expressing an alternative view right now? This is a level of uniformity we really haven't seen since before, you know, Boris Yeltsin.
Yeah, there are. I mean, there's even in the Russian media, there is a spectrum. It's not like Soviet times. I myself did live 5 years in the Soviet Union, and even Putin's Russia is a different place. Right now, Russians are in this mood, and it would be a big mistake to think otherwise.
And strategically, the fact that Vladimir Putin seems to make much of the naval fleet in Sebastopol in Crimea, now welcomed back into Russian territory, does that deliver to the West some idea that that navy might have something to do in the next few years?
I don't think so. I think the whole question can't be narrowed to Sevastopol, although it is a big plus for Putin that they now don't have to negotiate the lease on that naval base with Ukraine anymore. Still, you know, the Black Sea is a kind of an inland lake, and you do have to traverse through the Bosphorus, which is controlled by Turkey, a NATO country, to get out into the wider seas. So, no, I don't think it's a strategic threat right there. But the fact of Russia annexing another country's territory like that is a new circumstance for the world.
Fred Weir, Moscow correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Thanks so much, Fred.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Tickets, please.
Movie Time on Friday with the co-hosts of the Movie Date podcast, Rafer Guzman and Kristen Meinzer. Rafer, the film critic for Newsday, and Kristen Meinzer, the producer for the brand new Sporkful podcast. Kristen and Rafer, welcome.
Hi, John.
So, all right, my kids are crazy for Seth Rogen meets Zac Efron in the movie Neighbors. Let's hear a clip.
Well, hey, man, if you guys ever need anything or we get too noisy, just talk to me or talk to Pete. We'll take care of it.
Same with us. I mean, we get pretty loud over there.
Yeah, yeah. We're
Game
busy.
Of Thrones, we get loud. When Khaleesi comes on, I'm like, ah! Yeah, it's crazy.
Now, this feels a little bit like Pacific Heights, the horrible, horrible Tenant meets Animal House. How did it work out, Rafer?
Well, I think the big marketing shtick here is sort of Rogan, the schlub, versus Zac Efron, the hunk. There's actually a little bit more to the movie than that, although they are very good together. They do a lot of really good slapstick together. Every now and then, the movie finds a little bit of a deeper psychology versus, you know, the aging dad versus the carefree kid. They each see something in each other that they don't like.
Bob Hope, Bing Crosby, maybe?
It could be maybe like Thomas Berger's Neighbors, if you remember that novel. But it's, you know, at moments, it kind of has a little more depth to it than you might expect.
Kristen?
Yeah, I mean, this movie is a wacky comedy. It's rated R. Your kids can't see it unless you sneak them in, probably.
I know. They'll see it, but I won't be a part of it.
There's tons of drugs, tons of drinking, everything you'd expect in a frat comedy, lots of sex, but it really does have some heart, and there are moments where I felt very touched, but there were moments where I was laughing so hard that our whole row was shaking, I think, when we watched this, Rafer. I really
love this. Rogan is
talented.
Rogan is legit.
But all of them had great chemistry. And Efron's
a surprise here. He's actually quite good.
That's great.
Yeah,
that's
and
great
Rose Byrne, and women are frequently left out of the comedy in these kinds of movies, but even she gets some good moments.
Kind of a rave. Let's move on to the inevitable movie, Chef. It's got a great cast. Let's hear a clip.
You know your son's a cook now?
I'm a line cook.
He's a line cook.
Be careful.
I'll have him home in time for school.
It looks here like you guys are having so much fun.
All right, give me 1 second. Do you know your son could work a grill?
I had beer.
What is that?
He says he misses you.
This is all of the sort of angst of the reality show Chef shows put into a kind of fable, a morality tale for our time. Does it work, Kristen?
You have an angry chef who has such a short temper that he can't hold down his job. He has to branch off on his own, run a food truck. And a lot of it's kind of food porn. You're watching him prepare food, and that part is beautiful about the movie. But a lot of the other stuff surrounding it, not so much. I think it's overly long. It's hard watching this guy be a really crappy father. And then there are also just moments where I feel like I'm watching an ad for Twitter or for Vine or for something else. You even hear it in that clip there, like, oh, it looks like you guys are having a great time. That's because you're constantly seeing them update their social media platforms.
You mean in the captioning?
On screen,
technique, they go kind of crazy with that.
Yeah.
So John Leguizamo, Scarlett Johansson, this doesn't work?
I actually think it does work, just barely. I really enjoyed it. I mean, you were talking about you know, the angst of the chef contest. The one problem with this movie is there's no angst whatsoever. Mm. Everything goes really well, pretty much from start to finish, and there's no real plot or story to it. But it's got a lot of love put into it that Jon Favreau put into it, and I think it kind of works.
And just in time for Mother's Day, Mom's Night Out.
Stand down! I will tase you, woman.
How dare you? My husband is pastor
at first. Sir, they just came in here and started... That was an accident.
This seems to play like, you know, Passion of the Christ meets, meets Tyler Perry. I don't know. This is sort of a warm family comedy with Christian overtones. Kristen, does it work?
I wouldn't even say they're overtones. They're very strongly in there. A lot of people are probably going to walk away thinking this is Tyler Perry for white people. And there are lots of messages about Jesus, about God, and about men's and women's roles that feel sometimes kind of sexist, actually.
Could be a good thing, though, maybe, for a certain audience.
I mean, maybe. I think even a certain audience is going to see that this movie is so woefully inept that it really barely counts as a movie. It's more like it's just a string of random scenes of people screaming at each other.
Which suggests it probably will have a huge box office based on your guys.
I think even this is a faith-based film that people are not going to turn out to see.
But its biggest sin is being not funny.
Oh, this is great. Good line. Podcast, quickly, before we go.
We're going to talk about some of these films and one that we didn't get to, which is the latest sequel to The Wizard of Oz, Legends of Oz, Dorothy's Return.
Co-hosts of the Movie Date podcast, film critic for Newsday, Rafer Guzman, and producer for the Sporkful podcast, Kristen Meinzer. Call your moms, guys.
Thanks, John. Yes.
And now the world watches, Nigeria waits, and the fate of scores of young girls kidnapped by the terrorist group Boko Haram is unknown. The world is responding, though. A U.S. team of military experts is reportedly on the ground to help with the rescue of the estimated 276 kidnapped schoolgirls. U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is sending a high-level delegation to help with the mobilization against Boko Haram militants. The collision of terrorist brutality, government incompetence, and enormous oil wealth in Nigeria reveals a nation that cannot protect its citizens and that perhaps until now hasn't even considered them much of a priority. We've spoken to Nigerian expatriates, artists, and filmmakers about the meaning of this terrible crisis. Today, feminist author and civil rights activist Bell Hooks tells us that the young girls, in her view, are pawns in a larger struggle against a government structure that has failed the people of Africa and maybe the world. The parent protesters calling for action on the streets of Nigeria are on the front lines of this struggle.
Overall, it's about a struggle for nation-state power and who's going to be in control. It's interesting that the bodies of girls become the violent territory. It's clearly something that's getting the attention of the world because of it being every parent's fear, loss of a child. I think it's just tapping into intense emotionalities around the globe.
Do you think there's a unstated notion here that, girls are not valued as much in societies, be they Nigerian or elsewhere, and that to use them as chits in this kind of ideological war between men has a sort of darker message?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, part of it is the way that, quote, feminism is often blamed for chaos in many countries, as though the chaos of imperialism or capitalism or other forms of domination isn't enough. Because behind all this, of course, is the blaming of those women and men who have struggled to make education possible for girls in the world.
There's such a sense of demoralization that the institutions are not capable of addressing these issues, and these poor young girls are sort of caught in the balance. Do you think institutions have lost their ability to address these kinds of deep questions of equality, gender equality, racial equality?
Well, I think that people don't want to accept that we're not very far along the road to gender equality. And even in the states where we have, I would say we have much more gender freedom than the rest of the world, but we don't necessarily have gender equality. And we have much more of a class-driven gender freedom. That is to say, the higher your class as a woman, no matter your race, the more likely you are to have things that we would call freedom or liberation.
When people in the West look at what's going on in Nigeria and say, boy, it's completely crazy over there, but I'm glad I'm not any part of that, you really hear alarm bells when people in the West do that.
Well, I hear the same old cultural imperialism that has allowed us to ignore, for example, the traffic in girls in this society. I mean, the traffic in girls in this society is primarily Black and Latina girls. It starts at age 13, but people tend not to point to that as a sign of what's wrong with our country, that there should be all of these girls being driven to prostitution or slavery or murdered. because they are really a non-visible class. And that's part of what makes the Nigerian situation so stunning to the world, because it's like you've taken a class of people that are normally invisible and brought them into a certain kind of visibility.
What do you think prevents the world from taking the events in Nigeria and having a broader conversation about everywhere in the world where this kind of enslavement goes on one way or another, even if it's unrecognizable to the Boko Harams of the world?
We can't just focus on these things and be aware of them. That means nothing if we're not making some step towards change, challenge, transformation. And most people don't want to take that step, but they'll take the step maybe of being aware of having, oh, isn't that terrible, without thinking, well, how are we all implicated in this? I mean, everyone is noticing that, you know, just as Nigeria was trying to announce itself as having a better economic program for Africa and being a kind of symbol, that this happens. And so clearly there's an intersectionality between what's happening with these girls and what's happening with the larger question of the economic survival of Nigeria.
What would you look for from the United States besides military aid as a powerful message to combat what's going on there and the attacks on women and the society at large?
Well, I would look first and foremost for the United States to own its own culpability in having similar problems on different scales, because I think if we'd only act as though we can be the saviors, rescuers, helpers, then we're just reproducing an old colonial model. And if we're not saying, you know, these are the circumstances in our society that are similar in some ways, and this is what we are doing to combat that. And so we can't, because everywhere in this nation, black girls, black females are disappearing or being battered and murdered, and our nation actually isn't doing anything. So how can we then dare to assume that we can help Nigeria solve its problem?
What do you say to the person who might react to what you've just said as, oh boy, there we go. The Takeaway has this voice on blaming America for what's going on in Nigeria. Man, that is crazy.
But not at all blaming, but holding the U.S. accountable for what goes on in the U.S. and saying that a lot of times when we are focusing on other countries, we're obfuscating and turning away from what is actually going on in the country we live in. So I'm much more saying, let's look at the link between what happened, the violence against girls in Nigeria, and the violence against girls here in the United States, particularly black girls.
Bell Hooks is a feminist scholar, author, and social activist. Next week, we'll hear more from her, a larger discussion about socioeconomic disparities here in the United States, and why she says the lean-in philosophy doesn't work for everyone. Talk about big bangs.
Just look at the history of everybody doing big projects, and it's never driven by exploration. It's never driven by science. It's never driven by curiosity. Not if it's big and expensive. It's driven by the fact that people don't want to die.
Astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson speaking there is kind of like an exploding star of the new Cosmos series. He's an evangelist for science in the tradition of Carl Sagan. How did he get this way, though? Big, brash, funny, full of energy, with quirks like his strange ties and colorful vests, as well as quarks. How did he get this way? Well, for Mother's Day, we put that question on the origins of Neil deGrasse Tyson to his charming, unstoppable mom, Toni Tyson, who with her husband raised Neil and two other kids in New York City. Toni Tyson had us at hello from the moment we welcomed her into the studio.
I'm delighted to be here.
You know, I think of you as kind of the, you're the neutron star that gave birth to Neil deGrasse Tyson. Yes? Something like that.
Oh, that's really very funny. I don't look at it that way.
That's a gift to the universe.
Oh, my dear. I just look at him as one of three of my children. But it's all been very exciting, I might say.
You know, part of the reason for talking to you and what we're thinking about on this sort of Mother's Day weekend is, you know, you get gifts for your mom for Mother's Day. But every mother gives a gift, you know, obviously the gift of life, but there are questions of guidance and mentorship and advice and sort of being there. What do you think the biggest gift is you gave as a mom to your kids?
I personally think being an urban mom and being in an environment where everything was available as an educational tool. We used New York City as a lab for our three growing children. One was interested in art, the other in horseback riding, wanted to be a veterinarian, and Neil wanted to be an astrophysicist. I had no idea what an astrophysicist did. And when he originally told us that, I said, oh, that's very nice. I didn't know what it was. I had to look it up. Okay, and then when I finally found out, we went on a trail. We said, let's see where this will take us in terms of what opportunities are available here in within the five boroughs. And we took advantage of the American Museum of Natural History, the planetarium. That was his second home. He took classes at the Hayden Planetarium, and he was sometime the youngest child in the class. It was all very exciting. We enjoyed it very much. It was a wonderful time bringing them up in New York City.
And now he's, you know, roaming the galaxy on Fox television. Jeez.
I know in his spaceship, all of these ordinary, hardworking Americans who can sit in front of their television and be exposed to pure science, I think that's really wonderful.
Do you think it's a vision that your son had to do something like that, to carry on Carl Sagan's vision?
Well, he was absolutely, absolutely amazed when Carl Sagan invited him up to Cornell. I mean, he was in a state of shock. There's no two ways about it. And he was so thrilled. And, of course, Cosmos was done before that. And then when Annie approached him about it, he was just, again, thrilled at the concept of being able to do this again.
You know, he's such an expert on so many things. But for him, what are you an expert about?
People.
Really?
Yeah. You have a certain perception. You look at people and you see the interaction and the subtleties involved. And I think my generation has it because my generation went through the Depression. We had hard times. You know, we grew up in a poor city. And we had to be perceptive in order to, the name of the game was survival.
Hmm. Civil rights era?
Absolutely. School strikes. I walked a picket line with them.
You got to size people up.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And join that horrible New York City public school strike. All three of them were in different, they were all in public school, elementary, junior, and senior. And I went across the picket line. I think it was with Neil we went through. And some of the parents were already in the building, and the police tried to stop us. And I just told Neil, just hold my hand, don't say a word, just follow me. But that was a very, very uncomfortable experience.
Well, I wonder if we could, drag your son away from his public for a couple of seconds to just wish you a happy Mother's Day.
Let's see. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Oh, what have we here?
Hello.
Hello. Hello.
Hello,
corazón. How are you? Do you know that I am presently on the air?
You are.
And I understand that you are supposed to give me Mother's Day greetings, even though I'll see you on Sunday.
Yeah, I told him that. I said, I'm not going to make it look like I'm not seeing you on Mother's Day.
Oh, you better do that. That's out of the question, Bubby. Because I've always told you and your brother and sister, every day is a Mother's Day.
And
Grandmother's Day, too.
Yeah, I mean, every day should be a lot of days.
Neil, she says the best gift, maybe the best gift she has given you down the years, and there's certainly many, but one she really mentioned in this conversation was her insights about people.
Well, I attribute, I would say, 80% of my socialization to being raised by my two parents. This upbringing grounded me in the reality of life. And it wasn't just, can you have a conversation with someone? But I would say more important than all of that is, can you understand how other people suffer in this world? And is there anything you can do about it? Is there any way you can devote some of your life's energy to remedy that? And I'm now quoted. I must have been an AMA session on Reddit where someone asks me what drives me. And one of the three things that I listed that drives me every day is to every day you should try to lessen the suffering of others, at least a little bit. Just it doesn't matter what. Just helping someone across the street, giving someone directions, bringing food to someone. And I got this entirely from my parents. There was never a day of my life where I wasn't exposed to this. And I would say that's a fundamental part of who I am as a as a person and even as a professional.
Neil, you keep this up, I'm going to be crying all over the microphone.
Oh, no.
Yeah, we don't want her to cry, but I do have something that I do need to ask the two of you about, okay?
Go for it.
Tony, can you help me to understand the really crazy ties your son wears?
It's showbiz. It's showbiz.
No, I would wear them. No, let me correct that. I would wear them even if no one was looking. And if you go to any astronomy conference where you never heard of half the people there, everybody's wearing a geeky astronomy tie. It's just our little way of wearing our profession, not on our sleeve, but on our chest. And so now, if you want to psychoanalyze that, go ahead.
Well, no, it's a philosophical question. If a geeky astronomy tie falls in the forest, is it still Neil deGrasse Tyson?
I would find it. I would feel the vibe. I'd feel the energy field that would radiate, and I'd be, because even of all my geek friends, I probably own more geeky ties than they do. I have probably more than 100.
All right. Well, we're gonna let you go, Neil. But please, if you would be so kind, just wish your spectacular mom a happy Mother's Day before we go.
Mom, happy Mother's Day, and you know we're all gonna be together. So. But well, I don't mind wishing it twice. Happy Mother's Day.
Okay, Corazon. You don't have to wear your tie.
Okay. I'll leave it at home.
Okay,
sure. All
right. See you then.
All right, guys.
Bye. Thanks
Take
for
care.
Calling.
Bye. Mm-hmm.
And
well,
thank
that
you
was a
so
surprise.
Much.
Well, you're quite welcome.
And thanks for, you know, improving the cosmos.
I'm delighted.
Tony Tyson, mother of Neil deGrasse Tyson, on this Mother's Day weekend. If you would like us to showcase the gifts your mother gave you, share them at thetakeaway.org. We'll put them online. And moms, keep those gifts coming. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. Happy Mother's Day.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Reputation.com, encouraging everyone to check their online search results because search results define you or your business. Learn more at Reputation.com. TiVo. Able to search cable TV, on-demand libraries, and streaming content from Netflix and Hulu Plus on a single screen. Available at TiVo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.